From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The president of Belarus today defended his decision to force a passenger jet to land in order to arrest an opposition journalist who was on the plane. President Alexander Lukashenko also accused European leaders of using this as a way to interfere with his country's affairs and strangle his nation by ordering new sanctions. The EU has weighed in, calling the move to divert the plane an act of piracy. The EU has also banned Belarusian airlines for using airspace over member countries, including Lithuania. That's where the plane was about to land before it was diverted. Gabrielis Landsbergis is the foreign minister of Lithuania, and he joins us now. And foreign minister, do you support new sanctions against Belarus?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the ways to show that these type of actions, piracy, or as we call it, state-sponsored terrorism, has a price tag, that it's absolutely not okay to hijack a plane, kidnap more than 100 passengers on it. So it must have consequences, and I'm really pleased that European leaders found a consensus on that.
I also want to ask you more about that, though. Why do you think the EU is so reluctant to take stronger action, though, against Lukashenko, like sanctions on industries that provide him with vital foreign currency?
After last year's stolen election, which was stolen by Lukashenko, I think that Europe was quite united. But I think that there was a search for a balanced approach that would not hurt the regular people in the country, but would be aimed, and I mean the sanctions would be aimed towards the sectors or the companies that actually finance the regime. After these events, I think that Europe is already taking a much stronger stance. The decision was made basically just a day after the incident, which rarely happens in the Union of 27 countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, President Lukashenko has been telling his people that he's defending Belarus from NATO aggression, and he's stepped up his military state of readiness on its borders, including the border of Lithuania. Are you worried there might be a military incident?
You know, on one hand, we're quite convinced that that Lithuania and other NATO countries that are bordering Belarus are safe, because we are being defended not only by our own military, but also by our allies. But when we consider the fact that actually what happened on Sunday, which was absolutely unthinkable before, it might appear that that Lukashenko has crossed certain red line, where after which it's very difficult to tell where he would stop. So I would say this, that in general, I'm not expecting any military intervention or any aggressive action towards NATO countries. But one cannot exclude a certain provocations that might happen just because Lukashenko is trying to prove whatever point he has.
Former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice famously called Belarus's government under Lukashenko the last remaining true dictatorship in the heart of Europe. That was back in 2005. The opposition journalist who was arrested, Roman Protasevich, was an outspoken critic of Lukashenko's rule. Are there things happening inside of the country that we should be paying attention to?
Well, you know, the things that we are seeing now, they are really disturbing. We've seen Mr. Protasevich forced confession on video. So this is a certain humiliation that we very rarely see broadcasted anywhere. And when we have to consider that this is happening in the heart of Europe, and it is happening just 200 kilometers away from one of the European Union's capitals, namely Vilnius, it's really very difficult to grasp. And I think that we cannot stop just as evaluating the fact of what happened on Sunday. You know, all the democratic, all the Western world needs to demand the release of more than 400 prisoners that are being held in abhorrent situation in the jails and of Belarus. This should not be happening in a civilized world in 21st century.
Well, with that foreign minister, do you think that the EU is too focused on this action involving EU citizens on this airliner rather than this daily repression of Belarusians inside of the country?
Our goal and aim should be now not to stop with the decisions that were made yesterday or day before. I think we really should consider the possibility of using the legal systems of the Western world to put a legal pressure as well to the leaders of regime in Belarus.
Gabrielis Landsbergis is the foreign minister of Lithuania. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, New York prosecutors have reportedly convened a special grand jury that is expected to decide whether to indict former President Trump or others in his businesses, based on evidence from Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. Now, he has been looking into Trump's practices before Trump became president and claims that the Trump Organization may have manipulated property values and defrauded banks, and that hush money payments were made to women on Trump's behalf. Andrea Bernstein is with member station WNYC. And Andrea, this was first reported by the Washington Post. We know it's not unusual to convene a special grand jury in a complicated case. But what is this signaling to people?
Well, the former prosecutors that I have spoken to have said to me that this stage is a very advanced stage in an investigation. And what it means is that the DA believes he has evidence that a crime was committed. So it's a significant step. Now, it doesn't mean that it's going to go through this grand jury process where there will be witnesses called, there will be additional subpoenas issued, but they are setting up a sustained grand jury, a six-month grand jury, to examine whether crimes were committed. And it is typically the last step before an indictment if they decide there's evidence of a crime.
Yeah, and this evidence is from investigations that began with Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, who served time for admitting that he paid the hush money to women on Trump's behalf, something Trump denies. Other claims have to do with whether Trump or his staff either inflated or deflated his business value for their own benefit. Explain that.
So with regards to Michael Cohen, you might remember when he testified before Congress some years ago, he brought with him a check that had been written to him by Donald Trump, he said in the Oval Office, for $35,000 that had, Michael Cohen said, been paid out as a retainer, but in fact was to reimburse him for hush money. Well, in New York, you're not allowed to say something is a business expense when it's not a business expense. So that could be a felony. Separately from that, as the DA has been boring into Trump's business, he has found what he calls a possible protracted pattern of fraud, where Trump overvalues properties when it's in his interest, for example, when he's seeking a loan, but undervalues them when, for example, it's time to pay the tax man.
Yeah. Well, do we know if this convening of the grand jury has anything to do with recent reporting that Vance's office, the DA, has been pressuring the Trump Organization financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, to cooperate?
Well, both are signs of the same thing, which is that the DA's investigation is intensifying. Everybody that I spoke to that has worked with these kinds of cases has said that the road goes through Alan Weisselberg, that Alan Weisselberg is the person who oversaw all of these financial investigations, and he would be the one to possibly flip and give states evidence. So that could happen. The documents he's been collecting, the interviews with members of Weisselberg's family that he has been conducting, and going to the grand jury signal that there is a very serious investigation, that this is not just a suspicion at this point, but they feel that it is close enough to consider whether an indictment should be brought.
Right. What has former President Trump had to say?
Well, he issued a very angry statement last week when it came out that the New York Attorney General and Vance were joining forces on certain aspects of this case. He said it was a witch hunt, that it's politically motivated, and he denied wrongdoing. And all of that is a rather polite way of putting his missive that he put up on his website.
Well, we spoke with you last week when New York Attorney General Letitia James assigned two lawyers to work with the DA's office. These two investigations seemed to merge after her civil investigation into the Trump Organization developed into a criminal one. What does all this movement say to you about what Donald Trump is facing?
So Donald Trump, as we know, he has been sued thousands of times. He's initiated his own litigation, probably also thousands of times, and he's been subject to two impeachment investigations, numerous inquiries, but he's never been subject to a serious criminal investigation that could result in an indictment and could possibly lead to prison time. Now he is possibly facing all of that.
And just so people are clear, this new grand jury is separate from the investigative grand juries that the Manhattan DA used to issue subpoenas, right?
Right. This is a later stage where it's a more intensive look, and it signals that there is greater evidence that has been collected, and they're closer to taking some kind of action.
WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, thank you so much.
Thank you. Great speaking with you.
You too. A year after George Floyd's murder, the Senate still hasn't taken up a police reform bill named after him and passed by the House. And Congress is still locked in heated negotiations over an infrastructure bill. Republicans say they'll send a counteroffer to President Biden this week. And there's outrage over comments from Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, again, and the lack of Republican response to them. Lots to talk about with our political strategist. This week we have Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Alice Stewart, the Republican. Hello to you as well.
Hi, Robin. Great to be with you.
Good to hear and see, or well, not see, but be with you. And I have to start with you, Alice, once again. Marjorie Taylor Greene, let me set this up. She compared Americans having to wear face masks to Jews having to wear what she called gold stars. They were actually yellow. And then she went on to say, and getting in boxcars and going to gas chambers. She said, that's what we're facing with Nancy Pelosi's mask requirement in the House. She doubled down on that later. A yellow star actually marked Jews for ridicule and annihilation. A mask is to save lives. It took 5 days and the prodding of a powerful GOP donor for any Republican leader to respond. The donor was Jeff Miller. He wrote of Green, WTF is wrong with you? House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy condemned Green's comparison a few hours later, but just in a written statement, so there's no audio or video to be replayed. Alice, Green is a favorite of Donald Trump. We know that. Are Republicans this afraid of Donald Trump?
No, and Robin, I am glad to see whether it took 5 days is a question that baffles me, but I'm glad to see Republicans across the board giving a full-throated condemnation of these appalling and quite idiotic statements. And she definitely needs to face consequences. And Robin, as you say, face masks are about safety and protection. These yellow stars are about stigmatization and in advance of deportation for killing Jews. And Marjorie Taylor Greene not only needs to educate herself on this with regard to history, but she also needs to take a look back at how horrific these statements are. I have been to the Holocaust Museum in Israel. I have been to Auschwitz concentration camp in Birkenau. I have seen these gas chambers that she talks about with claw marks on the walls, people trying to claw their way out of these gas chambers. That is a far cry from what she experiences in the chambers of the U.S. Capitol. She needs to educate herself, and she owes the Jewish people an apology.
Jamal?
You know, I listen to this, and I think about Congressman McCarthy, who it just seems, in general, he's just a weak leader. And I'll associate myself with Alice's remarks. But it seems, in general, McCarthy is just a weak leader because, you know, why can't he stand up to members of his caucus who are causing the rest of his caucus so much trouble? And obviously, there's the fear of what happens inside of some of the Republican primaries. But, you know, Nancy Pelosi has a pretty progressive wing. Obviously, they're nothing like Taylor Greene. But she's got a pretty progressive wing in her caucus that she seems to be pretty willing to stand up to and say, hey, we're not going to do that. We're not for defund police. I don't care how many times you say it. It just seems like McCarthy is not just did not have the fortitude to be the leader and certainly not the speaker of the U.S. House.
Yeah, Alice, why are you able to say this? But it's not just McCarthy. It's all the top leaders in the GOP who finally made statements after 5 days. Why isn't she, you know, she was stripped of her committee membership, but why can't they ban her?
Well, look, they have done to this point what they can do, as you say, removing her from her committee appointments. And I commend them for finally denouncing her statements. But at the end of the day, it's her people of her district that voted her into that spot. And it's those people that should certainly vote her out. But I think it's quite clear that Republicans have made it abundantly known that this is not about the left attacking her anymore. This is anyone in their right mind who sees how atrocious her comments are. And to be quite honest, what I'm hearing from a lot of Republican House colleagues of hers is that she needs to be more introspective herself and realize, is she herself a Republican? Should she be in this party? And should she find a new home? Because she certainly does not represent the views and values and thoughts of Republicans.
Well, Robin, one thing is they could vote. The Republican caucus could vote her out of the conference. It would take 2/3 of the Republican members to do it. It just doesn't seem like McCarthy has the votes and the support in his caucus to dispel her, to get her out of the Republican conference.
Well, and we just wait to hear what she'll say next. But meantime, Jamal, you mentioned your party. There's some debate within the Democratic Party after the air war between Israel and Hamas. Over 500 former Democratic Party staffers signed a letter urging President Biden to hold Israel accountable. Now, in what we were just discussing, you know, Republican leaders finally condemning Marjorie Greene for her comments about Jews. They also did a little both sides-er-isms, you know. They also, in the same tweets, they, in the same breath, practically said, but Democrats are not supporting Israel and they're being anti-Semitic. Is this going to be a burden for Democrats down the road? Will they be seen as anti-Semitic? What would you advise Biden to do on this?
You know, the politics around this are tough because they are also changing. I was watching Rahm Emanuel talk about this weekend. Younger Democrats have only known Netanyahu as the prime minister, and Benjamin Netanyahu has inflamed the partisanship around Israel policy. You know, the truth is, most of my career, everybody was pretty unified around Israel policy. Now, I think about somebody like Amos Oz, the Israeli writer, who said, no, a lot of this is right and right versus wrong and wrong. And I think anybody who tries to come into this situation in the Middle East with a simplistic solution and a simplistic viewpoint doesn't understand the history, the longevity. I've been in Israel. I've seen, you know, some of the impact of this on both sides of what's happening. I felt it. My name is Jamal. So there were people who looked at me with suspicion when I was in Israel because I had a name that is associated with Muslim people. So I've seen this. The reality, though, is the Democrats have got to figure out how do they make sure both peoples, Palestinians and Israel, and Jewish Israelis, because they're Palestinian Israelis, how do they make sure that they both have a right to live, self-determination, to prosper, and to be secure? And I think if Democrats can stand on that footing, which is where Joe Biden has been, I think Democrats will be in the right place. And, you know, younger Democrats are going to have to, I think, spend a little more time paying attention to all the nuance about what's happening in the region. It's not as simplistic as many people make it out to sound.
Okay, if you don't mind, I want to move on to infrastructure. You have one comment, Alice?
Yeah. I just want to, you know, not to play whataboutism with regard to Marjorie Taylor Greene and Dem support for Israel, but they're completely different. But I do think it's important across the board for America to allow Israel to protect themselves. We need to stand by Israel, our greatest ally in the Middle East. And that's the important takeaway from this.
We also need to keep Palestinian babies from being killed. And I think we've got to make sure that the children on both sides of that wall are going to be safe and secure. And I think that's what most Democrats want, is to make sure we're standing up for the children on both sides of the wall that divides Palestine from Israel.
Okay. Great. Into infrastructure here in the U.S. President Biden initially proposed $2.3 trillion. He's brought that down to $1.7 to, you know, try to appease Republicans. Their counteroffer is expected to be much smaller, maybe about $1 trillion, which I can't believe I'm saying that's small. but Alice, do you think that, you know, Americans say they want this? Would you say to Republicans, hey, you got to get on board. You have to have a piece of this.
I say to both Republicans and Democrats in Washington, you both need to get on board and find a number that is palatable on both sides. I'm thrilled. We start at $2.3 billion or trillion. Now we're kind of halfway to that point. I think it's important to have these important conversations, see what needs to stay, what needs to go, but most importantly, how are we going to pay this without it impacting future generations? But I'll tell you what, I'm encouraged that there is at least some bipartisan conversation, and I'm optimistic that they'll have progress on this.
Jamal, do you think Democrats should go it alone, as some are pushing Biden to do, and, you know, own the joy at maybe all the jobs and all the infrastructure that gets built, but maybe own the bill too?
I was listening to Chris Coons on NPR today, and he seemed to be very forwardly leaning into trying to get a bipartisan deal done. You know, there's some practical things here, like Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who's got to be willing to go along with a strategy that only has Democratic votes. So a bipartisan deal is probably the best deal for the country because you need everybody bought into it. It needs longevity. But if the bipartisan deal does not happen, Democrats have to go it alone, because the only way I think that we stave off the barbarians of the gate who came into the Congress on January 6th, the only way we stave off that kind of future activity is to show people that the government can actually deliver for real people in the United States.
Okay, we got just a minute here, so I'm going to ask for 30 seconds from each. Alice, House Republicans refused to back an investigation into the Capitol insurrection without an investigation into what they called, race violence or violence at racial justice protests. Mistake?
Yes. Look, political violence of all stripes is certainly something we need to get to the bottom of, but that is not the same as an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol threatening our elected officials and an affront to our election process. That does need to be fully investigated and full transparency.
Jamal, a year after George Floyd's murder, your thoughts, 30 seconds.
I think that we are, we've made a lot of progress, but not as much as we think. $50 billion has been pledged, and only $250 million has been expended so far. We got a lot of work to do to deal with systemic racism.
Jamal Simmons, the Democratic strategist, Alice Stewart, the Republican. Thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
In San Jose, California, authorities are reporting multiple fatalities after a shooting at a rail yard earlier this morning. Police say a man opened fire at the yard run by the Valley Transportation Authority. Glenn Hendricks is chair of the transit agency's board of directors.
So a horrible tragedy has happened today, and our thoughts and love goes out to the VTA family, the organization, and what they've had to go through.
Aditi Banlamudi is a Silicon Valley reporter for KQED, and she has been reporting on this. Aditi, thank you for being here. I know it's pretty noisy where you are. There's a lot going on. Aditi,
yes.
What do police and witnesses say happened?
So we're still not quite sure. We're not getting a lot of information as of yet. We do have confirmed there are multiple casualties and multiple injuries, but we're not getting clear numbers as to how many people were involved in this incident. We also know that the suspect is deceased, and the SJPD are assuring public safety.
The Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office has said that as well, that the shooter is dead. Do you know anything about the shooter?
No, they're not sharing any information about who the shooter was, except that he was male.
Okay. What is it like there right now? What's been the response from law enforcement and first responders so far?
Right now, it's, the scene is looking pretty packed with, fire trucks, ambulances, police vehicles from multiple, cities around. I just saw a Milpitas, police car just drive by. There are still a lot of police officers on the scene, and it is still very tense.
Multiple people have died. Multiple injuries, multiple people have been shot. Describe for us where this rail yard sits. It's not far from downtown San Jose.
It's not far from downtown San Jose. I mean, this is an area where there, where VTA vehicles are being dispatched. It's a light rail yard, but we're not getting clear, answers as to where exactly this happened, within the VTA rail yard system.
Is train service still running through this rail yard?
As of noon, light rail services will be suspended.
Okay. San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo spoke just a little while ago at a press conference. Let's listen.
Now is a moment for us to collect ourselves, to understand what happened, to mourn, and to help those who have suffered to heal. That will be my attention today and for the foreseeable future.
Authorities will also spend a good amount of time trying to figure out the motive and just what happened here. What are some other outstanding questions you have as you cover this tragedy? And we have about 30 seconds.
Well, we're not quite sure what the relationship was from the shooter to the victims. All the victims were VTA employees. We don't really know why, people were out in the rail yard. Authorities are saying that they received active shooter calls at 6:34 a.m. That's around the time when light rail services start, but we're not quite sure what was happening around that time.
Aditi Balamudi, thank you so much for your time.
The last time we spoke with pandemic expert and Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Lori Garrett was November of last year, after the Sturgis motorcycle rally in South Dakota spread the virus around the country. At that time, she said that the gates of Hades have opened. And she was right, as she frequently has been since the outbreak began, and unlike then-President Trump, she knew this was no ordinary flu. Well, this week, the U.S. reached a milestone. 50% of American adults are fully vaccinated. Looks like the goal of 70% by early July may be reached. States are dropping restrictions. But, well, is there a but? Let's bring back Lori Garrett with her clear-eyed point of view. Lori, where would you say we are in the U.S. in this moment in the pandemic?
Well, Robin, I think that the vaccines are working better than even the manufacturers imagined they would. And they seem also to be reasonably protective, not 100% by any means, but reasonably protective against the variant mutant strains that are circulating, such that it is possible now to imagine America without the dire image of COVID-19. Now, that does not by any means indicate that we're out of the woods or that everything can go back to exactly the way it was in, say, September 2019.
Hold your thought on that, because I want to start with one question. Masks. I'm double vaccinated. I'm still wearing a mask because it helps with allergies. I don't want to have strangers have to wonder whether I'm vaccinated. But what about you? Are you wearing a mask?
Well, certainly in a number of different contexts, I still wear a mask. I still think there's reason for caution when you're in a crowded setting. People you don't know anything about, you have no idea whether or not they've been vaccinated, how many people may be in their home environment or their work environment who are unvaccinated, and so on. And we're not in a situation where people are waving around their vaccine cards or wearing special badges or anything that Marjorie Taylor Greene claims. So we have to have some common sense. Now, there is one thing I was very concerned about, and at least one new study has set my mind partially at ease on this one, and that is this. With polio, we had the situation with the Salk vaccine where individuals were vaccinated and protected against disease. The kids no longer got sick, but they did carry virus in their bodies and passed it in their feces. And so the community at large remained at risk until the Sabin vaccine was invented, which was oral, and which sterilized the virus out of the GI tract and therefore stopped community spread. I was worried with COVID that we might have a situation where individuals were protected against hospitalization and death, but they could still carry virus. The very good news is a new study shows very high levels of IgG immunoglobulin antibodies that neutralize the virus are in the nose and throat of vaccinated individuals. And so, in fact, they seem to be protected against being spreaders. So my initial concern about continuing to wear a mask was I wanted to protect others.
Why do you wear it now?
For two reasons. One, a kind of social propriety. Certainly not wearing a mask indoors, going into stores, going into bars, restaurants, and so on. I want to go along with the best wishes of the proprietors. The other is that, you know, I continue to be concerned about the variant strains. And we are seeing new mutant strains arising all over the place. And certainly the India strain has prompted great concern across all of Asia. You're seeing one Asian country after another that had fully controlled virus, a place like Vietnam that had so little COVID and had so effectively controlled it that it was considered to have virtually eradicated the virus from Vietnam. And now, because of the India strain, they have a real surge. Mm-hmm. Nepal, Bhutan, Cambodia, Thailand, Japan.
Japan. Well, I want to ask you, Lori, the Olympic schedule for July and August, you know, do you think they should be canceled? Others like Michael Osterholm of the University of Minnesota are saying the WHO should have an emergency committee to take this up.
Well, of course, it's complicated canceling the Olympics. There's only one body that can do that, and that's the International Olympic Committee. And the IOC is very loath to cancel anything because their whole income is about television broadcast rights. And so the IOC will have its own reasons for resisting any efforts. You know, I saw Osterholm's call and I thought, well, you know, that's all well and good, but it's not real world. The real world is that WHO has no influence whatsoever.
You mentioned variants, Lori Garrett. The variant that was first discovered in India is here in the United States, as it would be. You know, viruses ignore borders. You were talking about concerns and the fact that we probably won't go back to life before the pandemic. What are your concerns about the variant here in the U.S.? I mean, what does that mean?
Well, I think that America is very eager to go back to being the America it was, you know, before COVID. Back on airplanes, taking vacations, business meetings, conferences, movie theaters, the whole thing. But, you know, we don't exist in a planet that is protected. We exist perhaps in a country that is approaching protection. 50% is still a long way from the 80 to 90% we need, but it's getting there. But we are part of the world, and the world is largely unvaccinated. The world is largely unprotected. You know, the Brazil P.1 strain, the South African strain, all these different variant forms of virus have different attributes that make them either more rapid spreaders or more lethal experiences and escape mutations that can get around your immune system. I think we're tempting fate if, as Americans, we just jump right off that cliff and go right back as if the whole world was our oyster until we come up with mechanisms that transfer the technology and the capacity to vaccinate, the supplies necessary, the syringes, everything to countries from Chad to Cambodia, from Peru to Mexico, and see the whole planet get immunized. Until then, we're not out of the woods, and we could see wherever there is rapid spread of virus going on in a hot spot, there is the high probability, even I would say the certainty, that mutant strains will arise. And the question is simply, do we have confidence that none of these mutants will ever be capable of getting around all of our vaccines?
Well, right. Which is why some critics of the CDC wanted to keep tracking these people who get these breakthrough infections, even if they're double vaccinated, even if they don't get, you know, super sick and go to the hospital. They want this tracked so that we maybe could see an outbreak from a variant that is overriding the vaccine. Lori, that just brings me to a final question here. Your feeling in this moment, did this pandemic make us more prepared for the next? There will be a next. Or do you worry that human nature being what it is, people are going to revert to, see, it went away.
Right now, Robin, the World Health Assembly is convening. This is the governing body of the World Health Organization. And top of the agenda is exactly that question. Can we prepare a better system, a pandemic surveillance and response? Can we do better with the next one? There's talk about creating an international treaty that would oblige the signers to the treaty to technology transfer to poor countries, to full transparency in an epidemic and so on. Will any of these things work? Will any of it matter? What I sense already in America is that the vast majority of the once hyperventilating news media and the political establishment have already started to put the epidemic in the rearview mirror. And this is a pattern. Every single epidemic and pandemic I have been involved in, which is well over 35 of them, has seen this cycle where we go into a state of hyperventilation and then to a state of complete somnambulance and amnesia. Mm-hmm. And I can sense that already building in America. And I think it's the responsibility of all sort of politically motivated individuals who care about these things to put the pressure on at the local level and all the way up to say, no, 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 this time we can't repeat this. We can't allow ourselves to be caught with our pants down again. We have got to take the lessons of this seriously. We need to really analyze, why did America screw this up so badly? And what did we do right? And what can we learn from all of this that makes us better prepared for the next one?
Lori Garrett, pandemic expert, Pulitzer Prize winning science author. We'll link you to her writing at hereandnow.org. Lori, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Some Democrats want to get rid of the filibuster, but there may be one man standing in their way, one of their own, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Manchin has been very vocal against abolishing the filibuster. His position poses a problem for Democrats who are imploring Senate Republicans not to use the filibuster to block an independent commission to investigate the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Andrew Prokop is a senior political correspondent for Vox. He interviewed Senator Manchin for a recent profile, and he joins us now. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. So Joe Manchin's much-publicized commitment to keeping the filibuster seems contrary to his desire to push through legislation. Why does he think it's important to keep it?
He has this view of our politics now that the political ills of the nation come from too much extremism and unwillingness to compromise on both sides. He thinks that this explains everything from, you know, congressional dysfunction to the storming of the Capitol on January 6th to how Democrats have been really struggling in his home state of West Virginia. He told me, "I truly believe in my heart of hearts, if we get rid of the filibuster, we would lose the purpose of this democracy, of this republic, which is for the people, not on my watch. Is that going to happen?"
You know, it's a fascinating exercise to explore Manchin's political career as a way to add context to his position. And it starts in West Virginia. In 1996, he lost the Democratic primary for governor, as we know. How did that experience shape who he is as a politician?
When he ran for governor in 1996, he really was the candidate of business who ran against and lost to a candidate who was backed by labor and took more progressive positions. But then that candidate, her name was Charlotte Pritt, she went on to lose in the general election. Manchin's view of this is that she was simply too extreme to win in West Virginia, a state which was moving to the right. Manchin thought that the only way to keep winning there was to unite the party around his agenda, his more moderate approach. But he also made sure to bring in the labor unions to his big tent. And that really worked for him. That got him elected governor in 2004, reelected 4 years later, and then got him into the Senate when the state's senior senator, Robert Byrd, died in 2010.
Right. Manchin came to the Senate in a special election then in 2010. You know, there's this story of Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii walking past Joe Manchin in the hallway and referring to him as Your Highness. Of course, Schatz was joking, but it speaks to the power that Manchin has in Congress. He is the 50th vote, as you said, to pass anything that doesn't have Republican support. And while he's spoken quite a bit about wanting to support the Biden administration's agenda, in the context of the conversation we're having, could he also be seen as a roadblock?
Oh, absolutely. He is definitely the most public Democratic senator who is actually willing to put his foot down and say no. We saw he scuttled Neera Tanden's nomination to be the director of the Office of Management and Budget. And then we are seeing again with Democrats' major voting rights bill, Manchin has said that he thinks it would be a mistake to push through by changing the rules a bill to reform how elections are conducted in this country with Democratic votes alone. He told me in our interview that he thinks this will just inflame tensions in the country and lead to even more problems like happened on January 6th at the Capitol. So that has been the source of his power. He's been willing to say no, but he's also often willing to cut deals when Democrats really want something. He did briefly put his foot down with Biden's big stimulus bill, the American Rescue Plan, but then he did agree to a deal in the end. So there are these two Manchins, the deal maker who is with the party in the end, usually, and the more recalcitrant one who is willing to stand up and really oppose stuff that everybody else in his party wants.
Right. And he really enjoys holding both of those positions. He's actually said he is very strategic in the way he understands issues and the issues on both sides of the aisle and how to navigate through that. What does Manchin's political future look like? We know in his state of West Virginia, Trump won by 39 points in 2020, and Republicans hold every statewide office and the entire congressional delegation.
Manchin really stands out among current senators because, as you said, Trump won his state overwhelmingly. And if you look at other senators whose parties are mismatched between whether Trump or Biden won their state, his gap is by far the biggest. So the next time Manchin is up in 2024, it's going to be a lot tougher for him. He barely won in 2018. He won by 3 points in a very good year for Democrats across the country. This could also be his last term. It's entirely possible he could decide not to run again in 2024. So he's probably thinking a lot about his legacy at this point.
Andrew Prokop is senior political correspondent for Vox. Andrew, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.